It's the Burt Cohen Show. History every day. It doesn't happen as a spectator. Well, I suppose it can happen as a spectator, but it's so much more fun to be a participant in making our own future. Sounds like a dream, can't really happen, somebody else has the power, I don't. Nonsense. We have the power. We can participate in our democracy. We really can. I know it sounds daunting, but we're going to speak to the author of a book called Reclaiming Our Democracy. And this is the 20th anniversary edition. It's just been republished. Our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show is Sam Daly Harris. Thank you for being with us, Sam.
It's an honor to be with you.
Well, likewise. He is the founder of Results. And Sam currently is on a book tour for the 20th edition of Reclaiming Our Democracy. Well, again, Sam Daly Harris, thanks for being with us. What was your purpose in writing the book 20 years ago, and why is it now being re-released? What problems does it seek to address?
Well, basically, the idea in the book is that most everyone feels some despair about big issues they care about, that despair is unwarranted, and that there are others who've led the way, and we ought to pay attention to what they've achieved. The truth, though, is I personally started 35 years ago with my own obliviousness and my own hopelessness about these issues. So I didn't enter it as some academically trained expert. I was a musician and kind of going about my business, and just events happened in my life that kind of woke me up a bit. When I was graduating from high school, 1964, a dear friend a year younger died. 4 years later, Robert Kennedy, around the time of college graduation, was assassinated. Mm-hmm. And these deaths really got me to asking the why questions. Why am I here? What am I here to do? No answers, but it set me on a trajectory that I'm still on today. I love this quote by Mark Twain, who said, "The two most important days of your life are the day you're born and the day you find out why." And my hope is that this book really looks at the why question on a national and global scale. Now, of course, this doesn't tell you how I then got into the political part. It just had me asking the right questions to begin with.
Well, that's certainly important. And one of my favorite quotes among many from John Lennon, and it sounds like it fits you, life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans.
Exactly.
You didn't.
Exactly. And if I could say,
sure.
I was busy making other plans. And 9 years after college graduation, I was invited to a lecture, a presentation on the Hunger Project on end global poverty.
Ah.
And I never thought about that much. And walked into this thing thinking, well, it's inevitable global poverty because there are no solutions, because if there were solutions, somebody would have done something by now. But I went into this thing, realized the obvious. There was no mystery to growing food or clean water or basic health. I wasn't hopeless about the perceived lack of solutions, as I thought. I was hopeless about human nature, that people would just never get around to doing the things that could be done. And there was one human nature I had some control over, my own,
right,
and my questions. Why am I here? What am I here to do? And then the last step of this process was I spoke to 7,000 high school students, classroom by classroom, between 1978 and 79, on World Hunger. And when I went into the first classroom, I'd read some statements from the National Academy of Sciences food and nutrition study calling for the political will to end hunger. So I asked 7,000 high school students, about 35 years ago, what's the name of your member of Congress? I don't want to know if you met him. I don't want to know if you met him. Wrote him. Just the name. And out of 7,000 asked, 200 knew, fewer than 3%. 6,800 didn't know the name of their member of Congress, just over 97%. And results started out of this gap between the calls for the political will to end hunger on the one hand and the lack of basic information on who represented us in Washington on the other. And that's how I stumbled into this thing, starting with the wrong training, music.
Well, music never hurts, but interesting. You know, I imagine if you took that same poll of 7,000 current high school members, it would be no better.
I think you're right. Yep.
People just, I don't know. It's interesting how powerless people feel. And I know a little bit about the Hunger Project. The original goal, I believe, was to end world hunger by the year 2000. Obviously, that didn't happen, but it sparked a lot of action by an awful lot of people who did participate in that old Hunger Project.
Yes, and if I could just add that when we started lobbying in results in 1984 on child survival issues, UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, was saying 41,000 children under the age of 5 were dying every day from largely preventable, underlined preventable, malnutrition and disease, things like measles coupled with malnutrition. And the latest statistics came out 2 weeks ago from UNICEF. The 41,000 a day has gone to 18,000 a day. Certainly still scandalously high, but obviously going in the right direction. And that kind of change doesn't just happen on its own, especially at the advocacy level. People had to make some noise, you know, generate some conversation and some pressure to say this should be a priority. And that's what we did when we started in 84 and funding was about $25 million a year. And now it's $600 million and child deaths are plummeting.
That's fantastic. And it is, you know, it's so frustrating. People feel like they just can't make a difference. They feel at effect rather than at cause. And the reality is people can be at cause. And I think that's one of the original tenets of the Hunger Project. And if you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is Sam Daly Harris, founder of Results, and he's on a book tour for Reclaiming Our Democracy. What is Results? It's all in capital letters. Let's talk about that a little bit, what it is.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Results is a citizen lobby group. There are about 100 chapters around the United States, more in Canada, UK, Japan, and Australia, and elsewhere. Focus is to generate the political will to end hunger and the worst aspects of poverty. And some of the chapters focus domestically, some focus globally. And the second purpose is to empower individuals to have breakthroughs in expressing their personal and political power. And that's what we need to do, is have breakthroughs in that. In one of the new chapters in the book on a page, there's a small circle on the left of this page labeled your comfort zone. And to the right is a much larger circle labeled where the magic happens. And we need to find organizations that that don't just ask us for a click and a check,
right?
But and keep us in kindergarten and first grade as citizen activists, but help us move out of our comfort zone over to where the magic happens and into third, fifth, 12th grade and college as activists. And that's what Results in some of the other groups I work with try to do. And I could describe an example of the methodology.
Yes, please do. Yes.
Well, so one thing we have is a nationwide telephone conference call every month with hundreds of people on the phone together. So Results, 2 months ago, Jeffrey Sachs, the advocate from the Earth Institute at Columbia University, was a conference call guest with Q&A. And then last month, the guest was Paul Farmer. He'd been written up in the book Mountains Beyond Mountains for his work in Haiti and elsewhere. It was a conference call guest with a guest with Q&A. So you're kind of tapped in every month to this, you could call it, course on the tools to end global poverty as an advocate. There's more to it than that. There's a section where grassroots volunteers talk about a victory they might have had. There's another section that almost nobody does, which is to practice being more articulate. There might be a role play with a couple of hundred people listening in as one person volunteers to role play a call to a congressional aide or something like that. And, of course, there's always an action, a letter to write and other things like working with the media and the like. So that's a glimpse of what I call a structure of support that, you know, educates us in a more rich and deep manner than what's usually available to activists.
Yeah, you got to get outside your comfort zone, that's for sure, to take action. And that's one thing that, the powers that be rely on is people staying in their comfort zone. One of the old phrases by the founders of this country is that they govern with the consent of the governed. And if you're quiet, if you don't make noise, if you just stay within your safe little comfort zone, it's not going to change. But it can change. How people say, I don't have time. Getting involved in the legislative process must feel really daunting. How can you get through that and connect with people about getting involved and convince them of how good it feels to actually get involved?
Great question. Let me give you a couple of steps. Step one, I kind of discussed a little bit the getting to the why question. I mean, having it be okay to ask yourself, you know, what's my purpose? Why am I here? Of course, it's to love my family, to be good in the community, but who am I in the world or in the nation kind of thing? So people need to, I say the answer to the why question is we're here because we want to matter, we want to make a difference, we want to give back, we want to contribute, we want to leave the campsite cleaner than we found it, but that's all squelched down, covered up by discouragement and cynicism and hopelessness.
Yes.
And we've got to strip away all of those layers of cynicism so we can get to what's there, which is this desire to give back. So people have to get in touch with that. It might have been kind of snuffed down a bit. Number two, it's like, what do you care about? What's an issue that kind of gets you a bit passionate? And part of the predicament there is most people look at an issue and they have an immediate, nothing can be done about that, or boy, that's a hopeless problem, or there are no solutions to that one. And on the contrary, if you look a little deeper, if you look beyond your kind of assumptions about the issue, you would in fact find there are things that can be done about it, whatever it is. And then the third step is this finding this structure of support that I described, this something that really carries you much farther than where you start out.
Yes, and it can be intensely rewarding. That's for sure. People think you can't do it, but you can. And what a great feeling it is.
Yeah.
In the book, Reclaiming Our Democracy, the 20th Anniversary Edition, you quote Apollo astronaut Rusty Schweikert, who said, "We aren't passengers on spaceship Earth. We are the crew. We aren't residents on this planet. We are citizens." But so often, Americans, I think especially, just accept that they are merely consumers. How is it? Do you have a clue as to how is it that Americans have so widely accepted our own powerlessness? Why aren't more of us civically engaged? Talk, if you would, about the difference between consumer and citizen.
Yeah, it's just so much in the air. We're kind of born into the, you know, don't get too excited, you can't fight City Hall. Come on, you know, you can make a difference really close up to you at home, but, you know, in the wider world, you know, don't, you're just going to get hurt. That's all in the air everywhere. In fact, I would argue that, you know, our civics programs in schools are to learn civics for the test, not to use it.
Yeah.
So we learn it for the test, and we take the test, and then we're done
right.
with civics. And so, you know, the quote that you were going over by Apollo astronaut Schweikert, we aren't passengers on spaceship Earth. We're the crew. We aren't residents on this planet. We're citizens. The difference in both cases is responsibility.
Huh.
But we don't want to take responsibility for things we think are hopeless or are, you know, not going to turn out well. But I say in the book, in the mid-'80s, when we were just beginning to feel our oats the first time round, we would get up out of our passenger seats and walk up to the cockpit and realize there's nobody up there. I mean, if you do some deep study on an issue you care about, there's no particular reason why your member of Congress would be an expert on it yet until you kind of get in there and start informing them. If I could give you another example
sure,
of
yes.
a victory, we worked on microcredit, sort
yes.
of microfinance, the tiny loans for the poor,
yes.
beginning in 1986. And in 1987, the volunteers and results generated 100 editorials, not letters and op-eds, there were more of those, but 100 where the news, you know, Atlanta Journal or the Miami Herald wrote an editorial saying this microloan program should be supported, this legislation. And when we started in 86, 1 million people around the world had access of the very poor to a microloan. Well, now that's jumped to something like 124 million. And again, we didn't do it all, but at the advocacy level, we were in results in the microcredit summit, which I founded later. We were at the center of the advocacy work. And it's another example of, you know, making a difference. I mean, if you're an advocate for, this is not a 50-yard dash. This is a marathon. If you're in for the 50-yard dash, yeah, it might not work, and there might not be progress that you can see. But if you're in for the marathon, it can enrich your experience as a person and as a national and community citizen immensely.
And I wonder, my guess is that, I'll see what you think about this, that not everybody needs to do this, needs to run a marathon. You know, I don't personally run a marathon. Heck, I don't do a 50-yard dash either. But there's different ways people can get involved. And I remember back in the late 60s that, you know, when the perception was that all the whole boomer generation was, you know, activist, anti-war, you know, pro-civil rights, hippie types, my guess was the reality was only about 15% of us really got involved. But you know what? We did make a difference, and we are still making a difference. And everybody really can do that. You don't necessarily have to do the marathon, I think. I mean, that's not going to appeal to everybody, is it? I mean, I would
no.
think that would scare away a lot of people.
No, it's not for everyone. In fact, in my work, with now it's about a year and a half old, with the Center for Citizen Empowerment and Transformation, what I say to a leader of a nonprofit group is, would you like to be coached in finding and training that small portion of your members who want to go way beyond mouse click advocacy
mm-hmm.
and create champions in Congress and the media for your cause? And I could give you an example
yes.
of a couple of groups, one in particular, a Citizens Climate Lobby, that I've been coaching for 6 years, and they're doing extraordinary things, and they didn't even exist 6 years ago.
Such as?
Well, I get a call in 2007 in July from a friend in results, and he tells me, well, I saw an inconvenient truth on
mm-hmm.
climate change
mm-hmm.
3 times in 10 days. And then I went to Nashville to be trained with 1,000 people to lead the slideshow. And then I went home to San Diego, and I led it 43 times. And after the first few times, I realized I was giving people 98% the problem and 2%
uh-huh.
what they could do about it.
Right.
And that they couldn't buy enough Priuses or change enough light bulbs to make up for what the government was or wasn't doing. In fact, he said, I was reading the paper one day, and I saw an article It said the Congress had appropriated $18 billion in subsidies for the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah.
And I'd convinced 18 people to change their light bulb that day. This is never going to work, he said. So he called me up and asked me if I would coach him in founding Citizen Climate Lobby. Well, they started 6 years ago this month. They had no groups 6 years ago at the beginning of the month. They now have 135 chapters in the U.S. and Canada. And in the first 9 months of this year, their volunteers have had 873 letters to the editor published on their issue, which is a carbon tax and the full dividend back to the public. They've had 153 letter op-eds published, and they've had 639 meetings with members of Congress, Parliament in Canada, or their staff. Now, this is way beyond mouse click advocacy.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a really amazing testament to the difference that people can make.
Yeah, mouse click advocacy is so easy. It's all a rage. You know, you get an email, please click this, and oh, send us $5. I don't know how powerful and meaningful that really is. My guess is people, like, they feel like, oh, I've done something, next, I don't have to do anything more. But you spoke about a few things there, letters to the editor and editorials. I imagine most people feel like, ooh, I can't even, you know, write a letter to the editor. That takes a lot of effort, and people often write them way too long, which I think is a problem. But then there's editorials themselves. How can an average, I mean, how powerful are editorials on members of Congress, and how can an average citizen have meaningful input into newspapers' editorials?
Yeah, it all goes back to this, what I call the structure of support. If you're on calls every month with a guest speaker and Q&A, and you're learning little talks on the issue, and you're writing letters to Congress and the like, and, you know, you're getting really educated on this thing, you know, you'll try and call your editorial writer, and maybe they won't return your call at first. But if you're in it for the longer run, you know, you'll eventually get through. And if your issue is right and you're well prepared and you've got resources for them, there can be a breakthrough. Let me give you an example. There's a woman in Citizens Climate Lobby, lives in the Richmond, Virginia area, and she said, before I joined Citizen Climate Lobby, I was suffering from climate trauma. I would read Bill McKibben's book, Earth, and I would weep at home, and I would weep at work. And then she joined Citizen Climate Lobby, and 18 months later, she's co-leading a workshop on building relationships with members of Congress and editorial writers. And so she talks about the workshop on one of their conference calls. It was a year ago, August. And she said, you know, our executive directors tell us we're betting the farm on relationships. Now, notice, he didn't say we're betting the farm on mouse clicks or on messages left at the congressional switchboard.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we're betting the farm on relationships. And then he said to us, now go get a relationship with your member of Congress and editorial writer. And I said, most of us in Citizen Climate Lobby had never done that before. What in the world does a relationship with a member of Congress look like, and how do you get one with an editorial writer?
Yeah, really?
And she goes on, this is a great little bit, she says, well, I love romantic relationships. I needed a model, so I use romance as my model. That first meeting with the editorial page editor, it's like a blind date, only you've decided ahead of time you're going to marry this fellow.
Yikes.
If it doesn't work with the editor, you'll marry one of his friends at the paper, the business editor, this environment writer. Somebody is going to find you interesting and compelling. And she goes on to this amazing conversation, but I'm going to read you the last paragraph where she's visited 20 congressional offices, all of the congressional offices in Virginia, and I assume another 10 or something. She said, during our conference, I met with 20 congressional offices. I met with many folks whose view of the world was very different than mine. Going into their offices was hard. I had to let go of a lot of emotional baggage. I could no longer judge them or hold hostility in my heart toward them. I had to let go of my fear of climate change and my fear that they wouldn't listen to me. I had to center myself in love. Releasing fear and centering in love, this is sacred and profound work, end of quote. Now, don't forget, she started at climate trauma.
Right.
And most people, if they were to go to and come back from meetings with 20 congressional offices on climate change, they would kind of call it dirty work or hopeless work.
Hmm.
But I think we need to get to where this woman, Ellie Sparks is her name, where she's gotten to and seeing it as sacred and profound work.
Fascinating.
Now, there's a civics lesson for you.
Well, and it sounds like a lesson in kind of, I think, that the sort of Buddhist nature, you know, of you know, there's that, what is it, Tai Chi, I may be wrong on this, about, you know, you absorb the energy of your attacker and don't let him or her move you and just somehow transform that relationship. That's
yes.
Very, very interesting, I have to say.
Yeah.
You know, I would think, if say, for example, if my member of Congress or a senator were a right-wing Republican with whom I totally disagree, luckily she's not, I think she's great, but isn't the prospect of meeting with them really an exercise in futility? I mean, if they're just on the other side, how does that
work? I have to tell, one more story. And frankly, it involves her. And she got on the phone. This is in the Virginia area. She said, look, you told us to meet with our member of Congress here in Richmond. Our member of Congress is Eric Cantor.
Couldn't
get a meeting with Eric Cantor, so we got a meeting with his legislative director. And there were four of us who went, and we had two-hour preparatory meetings. And one of the four of us is a retired naval meteorologist, so he brought more of the science to the meeting.
Excellent.
She said, another of us is into meeting planning, and so he organized the agenda and had us write, ask the question, what are the congressman's values in the area of energy, economy, and environment? And the third of us is Fred, and he's Jewish, and the congressman's Jewish, and Fred's known in the community for his baking. So he baked two challah breads, one for the congressman and one for the legislative director.
Brilliant.
She said at the end of the meeting, the legislative director said, you're the most prepared group I've ever met with. This is their first meeting. They've had seven since then. He said, you're the most prepared group. And I would tell this story to the head of CARE or Save the Children or Oxfam. And I would say, you know, I think if I asked an ordinary climate activist to meet with Eric Cantor or his alleged director, I think they'd say, well, which wall do you want me to bang my head against?
Right.
Are you thinking that wall over there or this wall over here? And I was in a meeting with the head of an environmental group with 4 million stakeholders, and I told the story, and I didn't get to the wall banging part, the head banging thing.
Uh-huh.
And I finished the story, and the CEO says, you know, we wouldn't meet with the Eric Cantors of the world. And then the CEO cups the CEO's hands. I want to be gender neutral. And says, we meet with those who are with us. And then rocks the hands back and forth and says, or those we think we could move, but we wouldn't meet with the Eric Cantors of the world. Well, you know, you'll definitely not change them with that strategy.
Right.
I mean, I can't convince you necessarily that you'll change them by meeting with them. But they met seven times with Eric Cantor's legislative director, and the eighth time was June with Eric Cantor himself. Now, you know, that's some dazzling persistence and hanging in there.
That's really amazing. And I guess you talk about relational organizing, and it sounds like that's actually part of it, and bringing the challah to the member of Congress. That's brilliant. And you know, it reminds me, when you're trying to sell a house, a secret is, if you bake cookies just before somebody's going to come and look at it, and the smell of cookies, it makes a big difference. It really
this
does.
Is home. Where do I sign?
Right, and just getting along with them, and there's that old saying, you know, you get more bees with honey than with vinegar. It's a very interesting point. And one of the things that, that people certainly get frustrated about these days, Sam Daly Harris, is that, you know, especially when it comes to climate change, facts don't always steer the arguments. People, and in my experience, especially on the, you know, the right wing, the climate change deniers, they want to believe what they want to believe. It's been a task, a real challenge for scientists to disseminate the truth about climate change, but it's out there. How can mere facts break through strongly held beliefs? Is there some tried and true method on this?
Well, you know, I don't know, you know, what to exactly say. I mean, it takes a deep education, a rich education on the issue, which, for example, Citizens Climate Lobby offers. It takes persistence, which, of course, they offer. Yeah. You know, if I tell you that they had 873 letters to the editor published in the first 9 months of this year, imagine how many were written if 873 were published, kind of thing. I think I'd like to go back to results for a moment and tell you the story of that kind of turnaround. The group was in Atlanta, Georgia. It was 1985. They were quite embarrassed that their conservative Republican, in this case, his name was Pat Swindoll, had voted against famine aid for the famine in Ethiopia. Hmm. He spoke kind of proudly about it on the floor of the House of Representatives. They said, if watching your member of Congress was like a sport, we'd be sitting in the stands with bags over our heads. We were so embarrassed by what he did.
Right.
But they decided to shift, as you were describing earlier, and they took a prayer that a results volunteer in Houston had written for his difficult member of Congress. They put their member's name in, and the prayer goes like this. It goes, thank you, God, for Pat Swindoll. We know he's a good man who wants to do right in the world. We know he struggles with the same problems we do, closing our hearts to those who don't agree with us. There are no thoughts or feelings that he's had that we haven't had, and vice versa. We pray for all of us to learn compassion for people in our country and far away, for rich and poor. We pray that Pat and we will be less frightened of each other.
Yeah.
We pray our focus will be more to love and appreciate him and less to change him. Help us remember that sharing love with the world is the highest contribution we can make and will lead to children being fed and the planet surviving. Forgive our righteousness and anger. Open our hearts and minds to find the next expression of love for Pat that he can receive. And they would read that prayer, and at first they would go, yeah, really, yeah. You know, but they do it week in and week out over a number of months, and eventually, you know, it kind of seeped into them, and they would go to a session that's called Chat with Pat sessions, but they renamed Chat with Pat because so many people came to argue with the congressman.
Yeah.
But they'd come with a smile and a handshake and some information about difference that could be made around the world, and 2 years later, they asked him to co-sponsor microcredit legislation in 87, and he said, I'd be happy to do that.
Oh my.
I have a column in the local paper. Do you think you could help me draft, because we have to educate the public. Well, this is a guy who had voted against famine aid for Ethiopia 2 years earlier, and, you know, they changed their mindset, and then they educated themselves and him, and they persisted, and for them it was a big breakthrough.
That's a great, great story. We're talking with Sam Daly Harris, founder of Results, author of the 20th anniversary edition of Reclaiming Our Democracy. He's on a book tour right now. And what you talk about, and I think you alluded to this just now, you talk about partnership, not partisanship. And I think that's a very, very interesting point. And, the story you just told is, a little bit of patience. I mean, 2 years isn't really that much to change somebody like that who had voted against famine aid to Ethiopia.
Yeah.
Partnership, not partisanship. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, of course, you just have to look around what's been going on in Congress to see the partisanship and to see the need for some partnership. And so in that story with Ellie, when they were meeting with the ledge director of Eric Cantor, you know, that's an example of going beyond the, well, he's not going to be on our side, so why bother?
Right.
But to work, break into a partnership with his alleged director at first and then with the congressman later. There's this great story that one of the groups, they do a lot of research before they go into a meeting, and they were meeting with a member of Congress, it wasn't on climate issues. It was not going very well, but they recalled that the congressperson was co-chair of the House Wine Caucus. And so they raised the issue midway that, well, you know, a changing climate will affect vineyards, which will affect wine.
Uh-huh.
So the member of Congress got very into what they were talking about and said, you know, my co-chair is quite conservative. I'll have to raise it with him carefully. But, you know, you look for any kind of
connection, right,
you can make to get this partnership going instead of partisanship.
Yeah, we've seen so often where, you know, just assuming the other guy is your sworn enemy, you got to find something to connect with him or her on, and that can make a huge difference to humanize the situation. And one thing I'd like to get your feedback on, business, I mean, the business of America is business, and businesses are not always sustainable. This, of course, goes back to the central issue of climate change. You know, oftentimes, you know, business is about just the short-term quick buck with no regard to the long-term effects, pollution, creation of landfill and the like. That's especially true around Christmas in my mind. There's the developing model of social business, of being good corporate citizens. But again, if it's not profitable, businesses in general, they're not as likely to do it. Can such practices be shown to be advantageous to profit-making companies? Can there be some sort of enticement to get them to be better corporate citizens?
Well, I've had the honor of being in partnership with Muhammad Yunus, the founder of Grameen Bank, since 1987. And he joined our board at Results in 1988 and still is on our board. And this amazing story he tells, he was going to give a lecture at a university near Paris and got word that the head of Danone, the global yogurt maker, Danone Yogurt in the U.S., wanted to meet with him. And they arranged to have lunch at a restaurant, and then he would go on to his lecture. Well, they sit down, and the head of Danone and his senior team are on one side, and Yunus is on the other side. And they say, well, tell us about Danone. Tell us about Grameen Bank. And they say, what can we do together? And Muhammad Yunus says, well, there's a lot of child malnutrition in Bangladesh. Maybe we could create a Grameen Danone yogurt that's highly nutritious and inexpensive for the health of the children. But it'd be a social business. You could invest money in to get it going, but no dividends. You get your money back, but no dividends. That would all go back into the social business to do good. Well, the head of Danone stands up and sticks out his hand. Yunus doesn't know what he's doing. And he said, well, I read in your book there are no lawyers. It's all on a handshake. Yunus gets up, shakes his hand, and says, oh, wait, maybe you didn't understand. It would be a social business, a non-profit, non-loss business. You could put your money in and get it back, but no dividend. Stands up again, the chairman of Danone, and Yunus stands up too. And he says, I got in the car, and I sent him an email. Maybe it was my Bangladeshi English and his French English that he didn't understand. Yeah. And I repeated, a non-profit, non-loss, you get your investment back, but no dividend. And the head of Danone said, yes, I understood completely. And they decided they needed €500,000 to build the smallest Danone yogurt factory possible because they were going to use local milk and whatever.
Uh-huh.
And the lawyers from Danone come to say, you can't use the company money put in an investment where you know there will be no dividend up front. So they decide to ask the investors at the investors meeting if they would put a small portion of their dividend toward this social business. They needed €500,000. Well, the investors put in €15 million to the social business fund. And then a little while later, the staff comes to the leadership of the company, very irate. Why did you let the investors put money in the social business fund, but you didn't let the staff put money in?
Yeah.
They let them staff put another 15 million. Now they have 30 million euros, and they needed half a million to get the social business started. And so the other kicker to the story is one of the senior officials at Danone was doing a conference in Denver a couple of years ago, and he said, you know, we didn't do a lot of PR on this, but we're getting a lot of calls from other corporations who are saying, how did you do that social business? Because a lot of young people coming out of business school, they want to work with companies they see are making a difference in the world, and we want to figure out how you did what you did, because word is out, you know, about the difference that's going to make. So that's, I think there's all kinds of richness in that story about the desire of investors, not, you know, not all and not
right.
whole kit and caboodle, desire of staff, et cetera, to, you know, have their work lives matter beyond only the bottom line. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that's rampant, but it certainly is alive, much more alive and well than when I started Results 33 years ago in 1980.
Well,
it was a whole other conversation.
It's so interesting, and it does, you know, when you pay it forward, as it were. I mean, all kinds of businesses, corporations are trying to do some PR. How serious it is not always sure, but
sure.
I think people get it. People get it. If they do something like the Danone situation, that it over a long term, it really does pay off. You know, I wonder about, you know, people are so busy, especially these days, that, I mean, the middle class has just been decimated right now.
Yeah.
You know, people used to have a little bit more free time to participate in politics and making, you know, social change. But, you know, I wonder, this is sort of a two-part question, if more of us had a little bit more economic freedom, would more of us get involved in self-government? Is that what's holding us back because we're so...
Well, no, let me say it this way. A woman can come up to me and say, look, I have two really little kids. I really just can't get involved in this right now.
Right.
And another woman comes up and says, you know, I have two really little kids, and I have to get involved in this issue. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
It's different for different people. What their truth is different, and people need to be honest about their truth with themselves. And there's so much more to it. It's that structure of support that people need. Maybe I could give you this example.
Sure, they're great.
From one of the new chapters of the book, there's a woman who says, you know, I read this book, and I got very lit up about lowering our carbon footprint of our family. And she said, but after the effort, and I'm going to read a little excerpt, after the effort and money to reduce our household's footprint, I realized that while it was much lower than the North American average, it wasn't enough. We needed help. We needed others to drastically reduce their footprint, too, and only government policy could make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says, around that time, I was on the communications team for a rally on Parliament Hill in Ottawa. She's a volunteer in Canada. It was called C-Day, Fill the Hill. You know, two things struck me that day. One, the journalists are, for the most part, clearly uneducated on the issue. And two, we spent a lot of time and effort on an event that was largely ignored outside the few thousand people who made a lot of noise outside Parliament that day. I asked myself, what was preventing us from going inside and actually talking to policy and lawmakers about this pressing problem? Why weren't we doing that, end
uh-huh.
of quote.
Uh-huh.
And part of my answer to her was the sad answer as to why we aren't going inside and actually talking to lawmakers is that most people who want big change cannot find an organization capable of empowering them at a level equal to their desire for change. Most organizations ask us for nothing more than a click and a check. They see us as little children who are too busy with play, too distracted, too naive, and too incapable of doing the homework necessary to go really deep with our democracy. And then I close it with, but when citizens find an organization that treats them like capable adults, miracles can happen. And I think that's really true.
And I'm guessing that people, a lot of people really, maybe not everybody, but a lot of people really do care about making a difference in the world. And I'm wondering this, you know, you and I are baby boomers, but there's this large generation of millennials coming out, and now you have this 20th anniversary edition of this book. What about the millennials? Do you get some kind of sense that, they might be ready to, get involved, to take citizenship seriously?
Well, you know, I'm on this tour, as you mentioned. I'm going to 21 cities. 18 of them are college campuses. And I've probably been to about 10 so far, college campuses. So I'm getting a little bit of a glimpse. I do want to say, I think there's more energy on college campuses about social business or social entrepreneurship or maybe microfinance or hands-on volunteerism. I mean, when I went to high school, there was no, you know, kind of giving back to the community requirement for graduation. My son's in 10th grade, and he's got that kind of, see, that didn't exist when I was in school.
Right.
So all this hands-on stuff is more in the air these days. I'm not convinced yet that it easily transfers over to who we are as citizens and advocates. That's part of the reason I decided to do most of my lectures on college campuses. And, you know, we can hope that it'll make a difference.
There's all different ways to, affect change. There's letters to the editor, making friends with the editorial writers in the newspapers, having them write editorials, meeting with a member of Congress. And one of there's also, frankly, action out on the street, making noise, showing that, you know, there isn't consent of the government. One of my favorite quotes was from the May 1968 student worker uprising in France. And there was a bit of graffiti that said, "Be realistic, demand the impossible." Is there such a place for things like that? I mean, it seems to me like the old Occupy Wall Street was a bit of that.
No, absolutely. I'm going to actually talk about what you're talking about, protests, and I'm going to go back to the mouse click for a second. My complaint for the about the protests, which is not don't protest, is, and what about in between the protests? In other words, if the protest is today and the next one is in 4 months, what about between today and 4 months? And are we going to protest and not go in there face-to-face to have a human conversation? I'm going back to the mouse clicks. I was talking to Paul Loeb, who wrote the book, The Soul of a Citizen. And earlier this year, he was saying, you know those e-petitions to Congress or those e-blasts to Congress? Those are counted, but they're also discounted. And so, you know, I don't say to people, stop the e-blasts. I'm just saying, don't stop there. Or stop the protests. I'm just saying don't stop there. If the protest doesn't include a whole host of face-to-face meetings with your member of Congress and the like, preceded by really educating yourself, then it's incomplete for me.
Yeah, it's true. It's I had a professor in college many years ago who, pardon me, referred to such things as masturbatory politics. It sort of feels good, but it doesn't really get
it.
But, all right, I just got to ask one last thing about the Citizens United decision. How does that affect the power of an engaged citizenry? People feel like, oh, my God, there's so much money in politics here. Here's my voice.
If we're looking for reasons to be despairing and cynical,
there's no lack.
Citizen United will work. The gridlock and the government shutdown recently, that'll work. If you want to look for a reason to be cynical. But if you're really committed to, it's said one way, it's like, well, what was it like for Nelson Mandela 2 years into his 27-year jail term? You want to look for reasons to be cynical or Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi in terms of people who had an issue and were jailed for their convictions? Yeah, the point about the money, though, which is a travesty, actually, but the point about the money is it wouldn't work if the public was awake. The money is, I'm a member of Congress, I'm going to raise a lot of money so I can put some ads on the in the TV, so I'll wake up and just enough people to get me reelected, they can go back to sleep, and I'll raise a bunch of money to put some more ads in 2 years later, to put some ads on TV, to wake up just enough people to get reelected, and then they can go back to sleep. If we were awake, the ads wouldn't matter. I mean, if they were really doing baloney ads and we were actually awake, we'd see through it, and the money wouldn't have that impact. So it's, you know, I do put the onus back on us a lot. We aren't passengers on Spaceship Earth. We are the crew.
That's true.
And the difference is responsibility. Go ahead.
I was also going to say that, you know, the ads are there to convince us to vote a certain way, which means the votes count. Hey, if the ads don't work, it's our votes. It's the thousands and thousands of votes that they need. And, you know, we have that power. We really do.
And exactly. I mean, there's this great quote from the late Jim Grant, who was the head of UNICEF years ago. He said, each of the great social achievements of recent decades, and I don't know if he was talking about the women's vote or the civil rights movement. He said, each of the great social achievements of recent decades has come about not because of government proclamations, but because people organized, made demands, and made it good politics for governments to respond. It is the political will of the people that makes and sustains the political will of government. End of quote. Well, that's the good news and the bad news. If the political will of the people is a bit asleep at the wheel, then the political will of government will be a bit asleep at the wheel.
And you're talking about getting back to the intentions of some of our founders of the United States. Fascinating stuff. Very encouraging. I can feel your sense of optimism. It's great stuff. The book is Reclaiming Our Democracy, the author, and the subtitle, Healing the Break Between People and Government. Healing the Break Between People and Government, Reclaiming Our Democracy. Sam Daly Harris, thank you so much for being with us. Very, very enlightening and really good to hear. Good. We do have the power. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work it out. Think of what you're saying. You can get it wrong and still you think that it's alright. Think of what I'm saying. We can work it out and get it straight. I'll say goodnight. We can work it out. We can work it out. Life is very short and there's no time for fussing and fighting, my friend. I have always thought that it's a crime, so I will ask you once again. Try to see it my way. Only time will tell if I am right or I am wrong. Why do you see it your way? There's a chance that we might fall apart before too long. We can work it out. We can work it out. Life is very short and there's no time for fussing and fighting, my friend. I have always thought that it's a crime, so I will ask you once again. Try to see it my way. Only time will tell if I am right or I am wrong. Why do you see it your way? There's a chance that we might fall apart before too long. We can work it out. We can work it out.
The Beatles. We can work it out.